of the Yehuda, because if we have decided that that sturgeon is a non-kosher fish, then the issue becomes, can we drink beer? And fortunately, that has been anticipated, because the note of the Yehuda answered the question on the assumption that the swim bladder that was actually used for finding the beer was from a non-kosher fish and nevertheless permitted it. This was several years before he decided the question of the fish itself. And I thought that I would study that tshuva, but looking... looking over it, I find that it's a very important tshuva, but it involves a mix of so many ideas that it would be a little difficult for me to cover without getting so technical that either I'll put everybody to sleep or lose everybody, or just in general get caught. For example, we would have to go through all of the laws of Yikubaro, and normally that would take a whole semester just to state the various positions. I thought that I would instead study a tshuva of the Rav Avadya Yosef, which is a little easier to read, and it deals with a related subject, namely the use of gelatin. In other words, are we allowed to use gelatin? Before I get to that, I should say that I was there are various things that I wanted to get from Widener Library, but I sort of am not in the shape yet to get up and walk through the stacks. So, for example, I wanted to look at various things in Hapardes, and I discovered that most of the magazine Hapardes has, in fact, been put online. So I didn't have to leave the house. So that's the good news. The bad news is that they didn't reproduce absolutely every issue, and naturally, when things like this happen, it's the one issue that you want to see that was not reproduced. But they had enough in there for me to make the point that I want to make. But I did discover something related to what we did much earlier on. And remember, I asked whether anyone remembers what the situation was with grape juice some 50 years ago, and I discovered that there is a letter in here from Harpardes of, I guess, 1950 by someone called the Rabbi Nissen Telushkin, I don't know who he is, from Brooklyn. And he writes, Mitzanavim, grape juice, Hu'echad mimineha mashkeha na'asir mimitzchel perot. Grape juice is some kind of a fruit, one of the many kinds of fruit juices that are now on sale, from mitzchel shazikim, like prune juice, shel tapuzim, apple juice, shel tapuzim, orange juice, and so on. Sheragilim harve l'shtotam, aval afilu rubei charadenu, even the vast majority of our strictly religious Jews, lo dikdiku b'mitzze shel anavim yesh bo mishum stam yena. Nobody thought to worry that this should be prohibited. In other words, as I said, the practice was common to drink grape juice, and Rabbi Telushkin then gives a long analysis of why it should be permissible, basically the same reason that we saw later in the Tshuva of Moshe Feinstein, namely the process is completely automated and therefore should be permissible. So in the 50s at least, the transition to having the grape juice having become non-kosher was something that took place in the late 50s. Early 60s. An item related, as I said, to the issue of derivatives and mixtures, and one that's much more practical to us than the issue of beer, which we know you could have dealt with, is the matter of gelatin. And here as well, there was a long debate in Harpardes in the early 50s. The editor of Harpardes is a rabbinical journal, which was sort of published, a monthly rabbinical journal, which was originally published, I guess, in Poland in the late 1920s, and then when Rabbi Pardes moved from Poland to Chicago, it was published in Chicago, and then when he got old, the editorship was shared with Rabbi Elberg, who was living in Brooklyn, so I think it's still in existence today. And it contains many...
The name of a person.
Hmm? Originally the name of a person, or at least a play on the name of a person, and then...
His sister-in-law.
Whose sister-in-law?
Rabbi Elberg.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I see. Okay. There is as I said, Rabbi Elberg took the position that gelatin should be permissible, and he was widely there was a long article against him by Rabbi Teitz, which he published in the journal, and then there was a rejoinder. And towards the end of this rejoinder, Rabbi Elberg writes, Mikol Hanal, from all of the above, Yirekto Torato, you, Your Honor, that is Rabbi Teitz, you will see, She'em Shum Yesod Mutzak, there's no firm foundation, Esod Davar, to prohibit something, Shekvar Nitpashet Heter, something which has been widely assumed to be permissible, V'hutar Al Yedei Gedolei U'Gaonei Aretz, and which has been permissible by the leading rabbinical authorities. So Rabbi Elberg is simply citing again a fact that I remember, that in the 40s, my mother had gelatin in the house. You said that your mother had used gelatin. Unflavored Knox gelatin. So this was something which was widely regarded as permissible. And it was widely regarded as permissible, even though it's a derivative from it's collagen tissue that's made from either skins or connective tissue of cartilage and so on from non-kosher animals or trefa animals. In the 30s, there was a Rabbi Kanowitz, who was the head of the Agudas HaRabbanim in the 1930s here in America, and he wrote, "B'din mutar lasot avat ma'amid me'atzamot yedeshot shel nevelot u'trefot." Can you use a gelling substance? Can you make a gelling substance from a powder which is derived from bones? She'ela, ki ma'i echad hamsi min hadash shel avat ma'amid. A chemist has invented a new form of powder. The history is, I don't know exactly, probably sometime in the 19th century. I know that Peter Cooper gets credit for inventing gelatin desserts. That's the same Peter Cooper, Cooper Union. And he describes the process, and then he writes, and at the end he writes, "V'chein da'ati maskemet lahatir et avaka nasem me'atzamot." Therefore, it's my opinion to permit this powder that's made from the bones. Mitam she'esur shayyabo mikodem, whatever prohibition was there originally, kvar chalafa alach mimeno al yidei hashriya, has already been eliminated by the soaking in all these chemicals. Ha'yivush v'achom ha'gadol she'avaka ta'atzamot lavak dak v'yavesh k'mar kemach, which has converted these bones into a form of powder. Panim chadashot ba'olukan. Simply a new object that's come here, Bithon, Hesher, etc., etc., he permits it, and he sends a copy of this letter to Rabbi Chaim Moser of Lubinsky. So this is in the 1930s, I think he died in 1938, so this would be just around then, and who Rabbi Chaim Moser writes, "Lefnei shavu yamim higani yekrat mechtavo mehayom hamatzav atzleinu odenu ma'atziv." Our situation is deplorable. So this is writing in the late 1930s in Poland, and realizes things are really getting terrible and drastic. But he agrees, "Ubi'ikaha hara'a," on the main issue of what the law should be as regards gelatin, and hineni maskim imrod malat korotol ha'kel bazet emotion yifayer ba'chiez ha'chem. So Rabbi Brzezinski said also, he was one of the, if not the leading posek in the world at that time, permitted gelatin. And in fact, we have an interesting lineup here of the pros and the cons. The rabbis who permitted the use of gelatin were Rabbi Chaim Moser, Brzezinski, the Chazon Ish, Rav Tzvi Hasachran, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, and Avadu Yosef. Those are the rabbis who permitted it, and I would like to spend some time tonight and next week studying the Tshuva of Avadia Yosef. The rabbis who prohibited it were Rabbi Teitz, who doesn't have much in the way of standing as a halakhic authority, Rav Aaron Cutler, who's a big Rosh Yeshiva, but again not known as a major posek, but he took a strong stand against it. And, of course, our Hungarian friends, Diane Weiss, for example, who took the lead. So one was faced with a situation in which, in the United States, the triumph of the right-wing yeshivas meant that Rav Aaron Kotler's view prevailed. And in Israel, I don't know what the current situation is, but certainly until quite recently, gelatin was regarded as a kosher substance. So if you had ice cream with gelatin, it would not have been considered so terrible. So again, you have a conflict. And it's an interesting sociological phenomenon that what was occurring in the United States was that even something that had been permitted by the leading rabbinical authorities in the 1930s were overruled by the authorities, and not only the Hungarian ones, because we're including here Rabbi Kotler and Rabbi Teitz in the United States.
Well, now you see yoga product is kosher.
I'm not sure. It could either be made from kosher animals, which means that, they took special precautions to manufacture the gelatin from kosher animals. There's much less of a problem of mixing milk and meat together because it really has no flavor. So the issue of, there are many, many reasons that even if you regarded the gelatin as a meat product, it would not make the milk permissible, or they may have derived the gelatin or some substitute for it, like agar-agar. Whatever, according to the rabbinical opinions that I cited, it has nothing, it's no status.
If you buy a tube of candy in Israel, Mentos,
yes.
If you buy it in Israel, like a muffin and Yehuda, and you look at the hechsher, of course there's so many hechsher in Israel and outside the kippah, but you'll find two or three of the major hechsher on that, and what it says printed on the label is it's kasher wa ochlei gelatin.
Okay.
Well, as if to suggest that that's a whole...
What's happening, of course, is that the situation, the American prohibition, you have enough Anglo-Saxons, people who move from the United States to Israel, that they worry about whether or not it's permissible. As we will see, Rabbi Yosef is quite strong on this opinion, and I think you should begin. The problem wasn't gelatin, they were made with shark oil. I mean, the actual fat that was used was not necessarily the other fat. I mean, it was a much more serious problem there.
Well, I want to ask a Rob.
Yes?
And you told me that it's all right that it's made from an inert material, like leather.
Okay.
Not directly from the bone.
Right. And that's
you
that was...
It was all right.
No, that's if it's made from leather. But leather has already been processed so as to become inedible by itself. And then Moshe Feinstein also agrees with that position. However, he did not take a firm position one way or the other. He did not feel that he wanted a rule, I guess, against Rabbi Kotler, so that he did not permit the use of gelatin that's made in the normal process of just simply taking the skin from the roof.
I remember there was already an issue on the OK, which was against the kosher gelatin. That's why I asked him. Mm-hmm. I took him to New York and they also can't eat it, okay? And here people ate it, right? And have to occasionally ask them.
Okay, so what I want to do is study this whole subject.
As an aside, that has nothing to do with anything. Back in the 1930s, the favorite radio program in New York with Jack Benny, who was sponsored by Jell-O.
Right. Okay, so the first subject, so what's involved here is that we have an animal derivative that is something that has been processed so that it's lost its original shape and may or may not have become inedible in the course of production, and does that remove the prohibition? And I want to work myself up slowly to this problem. One of the key sources is a difference of opinion between Rabbeinu Yonah and the Rush on the issue of musk. So let me remind you, no, but it's used in almost all foods, or it used to be used in almost all foods as a flavoring. Yeah. Right. Of course, its main use is perfume, but it was also used as it's in lots and lots of foodstuffs. But let's first figure out what Musk is, so that we... So here is something that I downloaded from the web. High in the rhododendron thickets of the Himalayas lives a species of miniature deer, Moschus moschicus. Silent and solitary, this diminutive mammal, weighing less than 25 pounds and standing only 20 inches high at the shoulder, is seen only at dawn and dusk, feeding on tender shoots of dandelion and honeysuckle. Unlike other deer, it is not armed with antlers. In every regard, it is the most subtle, retiring, and innocuous of creatures. But in one sense, smell, its invisible presence, dominates not only its native forest, but the entire world. Only the mature male Moschus produces musk. This substance occurs only in only one location on the deer's body, on its abdomen, just in front of its penis, and it is a hairy pouch known as the musk gland. This sac is about the size of a golf ball. It is composed of several layers of skin with two openings immediately above the animal's urethra. In the early summer, unripe liquid musk drains into the gland from the surrounding tissues and is stored there for some weeks or months. During the course of time, the musk, 30 grams of it or so, matures into a granular, waxy, reddish-brown substance with an extremely potent and familiar smell. So that's what musk is. Yes. And but so the animal is practically extinct because musk is an extremely expensive item, and by now they have some kinds of imitations which are not nearly as good as the original. For some reason or other, which is hard for me to ask, understand, in Shmot it said, when it says, "Vayidaber Elohim Moshe le'emor v'yatav kach lecha v'samim rosh morot ror chamesh shniyot v'kinamon dosem chasmach v'mitzol chamishim u'matayim u'kmeh dosem chamishim u'matayim." On the phrase morot ror, the Ibn Ezra writes, morot ror, milat mor, kasher, it's a difficult word, v'hagaon tegma mosk. The Lipsa'adi Gaon translated more as being musk. It's extremely difficult why he translated it as being dusk. I mean, the simplest translation is that it's mere, that it's hadnik from current English word, which has the meaning of a spicy resin. And etc. And for some reason or other, the Rambam as well adopts Rupsar Gaon's position and translates more as musk. Now, here's this is an imported product. Very expensive. It was part of the trade to the East. Very expensive imported product. So now let's take a look at the rush here. I'm not sure, but it certainly was imported by the time of Rupsadia Gaon, so whether that was an anachronism or not, I don't know. But just on general grounds, it's unlikely that the meaning of the passage has to do with loss. Okay. So this is Simon Lamed Hei in Perek Vav of Rosh. Rehu Omer al HaMugmar, Omar Rabbi Amar Abiyomer, Me'emet HaMevrochim al HaMugmar, Mishita'alet Timrato. When do you make the bracha on the incense when the scent has risen? Omar Pista al HaMugmarot, Kulam Mevrochim Elohim Borei Atzei B'Samim. On all forms of incense you make the bracha both Borei Atzei B'Samim. Chutz Mimusk, Dimin Chayahu, except for musk, which is a form of animal, Shemavachin alav borei minei b'samim. So the scent, to make a bracha on the perfume, the scent of the musk, you make borei minei b'samim, not borei atzei b'samim. Yesh amuyim sha musk hu zeyat chaya. Some say that the musk is the sweat of a beast. V'nachon yoter shechaya yaduwa sheyesh lacha totot b'tzavara, which has an incision, a pocket in the neck. Actually, as we saw, it's not in the neck, it's in the abdomen. And something gets stored there like blood. And it therefore thereafter is converted into mas. Zal haya oser lo ochlo, but Zal prohibited eating it mishum chashash dam, because he thought that there might be a question here of blood. Rabbeinu Yonah Zal pirish the efshar li kein bo ta'am lahatir. Rabbeinu Yonah said we can give a reason to permit it. Lomar the pirsha ba'almahu, that it's just some form of excretion. Afal pishim of chilah yadam, even though it was originally blood, lo chayshinan lahachi, we don't worry about that. But the hachta aslina, we look at the matter as it stands now, that is, after it's been converted into Mrs. Musk, and he gives a proof. Sharei hadvash, for example, honey, im nafalbo hatikha shel isur, if some prohibited piece of something or other falls into the honey, the afal gadsha isur nivuam nimuach betol hadvash, even though the isur has become what's the correct word? Become sugarized, is that the word? When something becomes converted into sugar? Kevan shederach hadvash lahachzir hadavar hanofel l'tokol dvash, since it's in the nature of honey to convert anything that falls into it into some crystallized or sugarized substance, da'ina k'mo dvash da'ina lei, we consider it as dvash umutav. Hachinami apal pishim et kilah ha'yadam, even though originally this was blood, but the hashta aslino, we follow its current status. The apple pishin obtain time with shvachet hashil, even though it gives a pleasant flavor in what's being cooked. And Rush adds as a comment on this, that even his argument, that is, the proof from the fact that we eat honey with various pieces of things falling into it, like these legs and so on, itself requires proof why this should be permissible, so it's unclear that why we should permit this so-called blood that has been converted into mas. Of course, the actual facts are a little different, as we know. First of all, it's not blood that's been converted into mas, but rather there's just some secretion from the various cells which is surrounding this pouch, which is called the gland, which are pouring into this pouch. So therefore, it's no reason to consider the original substance as being blood. And in all likelihood, the animal itself is permitted. I mean, I assume that it's a form of deer, which is what would have been permitted to eat if we actually caught one and slaughtered it properly. So therefore, the whole ground of why we should worry about prohibiting it seems a bit far-fetched. But the development of the argumentation was based on the assumption that what we have here is blood, or at least some kind of a secretion from a prohibited animal, which has now been converted into a modified form. Okay. So that's one of the main sources here, the fact that Rabbeinu Yonah permits this mas, which is he assumed to be a derivative from the blood of a prohibited animal. Okay, now let's see what the Chazon Ish has to say about this. I just want to cite one item. Parash Brachot Perek Vav Siman Lamed Hei Hevi Divrei Havi, brought the statement of the Risha, Hetir Mas Hamitaveh Mitam HaChaya, who permitted the mask which was created, which was developed from the blood of an animal, V'chein Hatichat Yisur Shenatla Ledvash, and similarly, a piece of prohibited something or other, meat perhaps, which fell into the honey and became completely sugarized. On the other hand, Rav Zerachya Halevi and the Rush disagree with Rabbi Yonah's position. One can argue with this for two reasons. Echad, the whole isur hamishtaneh mitzura l'tzura, enok chashuv shinui, kevan shelo haya b'entayim sha'a shenifsal me'achila, anything that changes its form, that's not considered a change, because there was never any intermediate stage when it became inedible. Ela shenitchalek mitzura l'tzua, pashat et harishona v'alavak achona, v'ilchach gam hamas hu dam achaya, v'afil im tinsalomu de'en le'esol mishum dam, ולא עדיף מדם שבשלו, מכל מקום יש לאסור משום איסור טמא שבדם. So there are two false assumptions underlying this whole argumentation. One is that musk is actually a form of transformed blood, and the other is that the animal itself was prohibited. The musk is not blood which has been transformed into musk, but it's a secretion, and the animal itself is presumably permissible. But the Chazon Ish is arguing on the assumptions that of both of these are true, namely that this is a prohibited animal which excreted blood. And I don't want to read all of the details of what he has to say. Okay, Yesh La'ayin, we should invest, and I'm reading the last paragraph. Yesh La'ayin, Lama Chashiva HaBeitza Ki Isracha Afra. The Gemara in Tmura says that although you're not allowed to eat the egg of a chicken, which is a trefa, if a chick develops from that egg, the chick itself is permissible. And the Gemara argues the reason for that being is that in the intermediate stage, it passed through a stage in which it was not edible, and therefore it was just, when the chick developed, it was as if a new creation had taken place from the raw materials which had been formed from the degenerated egg. Okay, so Yesh La'ayin, Lama Chashiva HaBeitza Ki Yisrocha Afra. Why is the egg which has become spoiled, that is, like earth, Tevin Be'omedet L'Gabel, Maishna Meso'o She'omed L'Chamea Isot, V'Kemach She'eno Ra'uy L'Kus V'lo Chashiva Afra. Why is, for example, sourdough not considered Afra? After all, it's inedible, but nevertheless it's used as an additive, and therefore is prohibited. V'yashar d'v'inam shiyei mino omed l'chach. Aval ma shiyichei zeh l'chach lo mahani. V'ol d'chisaron bishul lo chashiv chisaron. Kamo d'mahani im yachol l'shoto meyek l'eit v'lachziro. G'l'inan mino n'gar v'meis. Ami mashba al v'hor azor v'ez, v'hu adin l'inyan isur. Aval im tzorich shviya yotel mi mi'eit li'eit. If in order for the substance to regain its edibility, you have to soak it for more than a day. Mutar. Aval rikum ha'vipanim chadashot, v'hashta eno u'ya l'kos. V'nira l'pizeh, he writes, she'im motzi'im b'mlechet kimia, if by means of chemistry we extract atomim mi'isur, we take extract some chemicals from something which is prohibited. V'notnim oto nachal kach l'machal l'takno, and we then put it in other food substance as an additive. Ein ifsal b'yemtza me'achilat adam. If at some stage in the production process this has become inedible to humans, ve'eino ra'uy lo b'chnei atzmo v'lo l'ta'ovet, and it's not edible by itself, and I don't know what he means by lo v'lo l'ta'ovet. Not edible by itself, or can't be used as an additive in that particular stage until the chemical procedure has finished. Afsha amad l'gmar melachto, even though the entire process was to produce something which could be used as an additive. V'havi ra'uy l'matek akdera muta. It's permissible. So in other words, if you have any chemical additive which is derived from a prohibited substance, and if during some stage of the production it becomes inedible to humans, then it's permissible to use it, even though the intention was to end up with something which was going to be used as a chemical additive. But if during the production process it did not become inedible to humans, in other words, what the Chazon Ish is saying very clearly is that if you have some chemical procedure, like one in which you produce gelatin and soak them in phosphates and whatever, or in acids or in lye, that's type A gelatin or type B gelatin, I believe. And during some intermediate stage, it becomes inedible for humans, then even though the intent of the production process is to end up with an additive which will be edible, that is, will be used as a food additive, everyone will agree that it's permissible. If during this entire production stage, there's no step in which the intermediate product is inedible to humans, then Rabbeinu Yonah will permit it and the Rosh will not permit it. So this is very clear, and that's the substance of the Heter, and we'll come back to this in more detail when we see what Rav Avadya Yosef's position is. Yes? If the substance started as inedible, then everyone will agree that there's no prohibition. Something which is inedible is not food and therefore is not prohibited. If you make, first of all, I assume that the things are made from cartilage and not from the bones. But if, for example, the original cartilage was inedible, then there may not have been any prohibition whatsoever. There's a long argument by Rabbi Teitz in this issue of Haparis, in which he wants to argue that the bones or the cartilage are in fact prohibited. But evidence would be that if the thing was originally inedible, it never became prohibited in the first place. Well, that's a new problem. Whether mad cow disease can be eliminated this way, I don't know. I mean, you should be careful about any kind of bone attitude, I suppose. But I don't know. Okay, I want to back up a little bit and discuss the issue of honey. Everyone takes for granted that honey is permissible. No one is going to argue with this. Don't come away from this shiur believing that there's some reason to prohibit honey. Well, how do you know it refers? How do you know it refers to bees' honey?
How is it that some honeys have a U on them and some honeys don't have a U?
I've seen salt with a U on them. I mean, I'm confused.
Depends if the salesman got there yet.
Okay.
You're a new salesman.
All right, so.
I met the rabbi who was in charge of putting the U on the salt.
All right. So, we all agree that honey is permissible, and the issue is why. So, the Mishnah in Bechorot says, "Harashi yalda kemin chamor." A cow gave birth to a creature which looks like a donkey. Or chamor shi yalda kemin sus. Or a donkey gave birth to an animal that looks like a. In other words, these are. Yeah, like a horse, but these are various forms of malfunctioning births. Patur min habchora, shenemar petach hamor shnei pamim, ad sheyeh havlad, hayoled hamor v'hanolad hamor. Umahim ba'achila, and what is the law as far as whether you're allowed to eat this offspring or not? The Mishnah says, behemat ha'ora sheyelda kemin behemat meya mutar ba'achila. If a cow gave birth to a creature which looks as if it's not a cow, like a donkey or something, it's permissible. Tmeyashi yalda kimin behemat ha'ora asur ba'achila. Shehayotzei mehatamei tamei, because anything that comes out of a prohibited animal is prohibited, v'hayotzei menatahor tahor. Dag tamei shevala dag tahor mutar ba'achila, v'tahor shevala tamei asur ba'achila v'she'eino gidula. On the other hand, if you find something in the intestines of an animal, if you find a kosher fish in the intestines of a non-kosher fish, it's permissible because the fish that you extracted from the belly was a kosher fish, and vice versa, it would be a non-kosher. Okay. The Tosefta says, "Mepnei ma omru vash dvarim mutar." Why did they say that bees' honey is permissible? She'ein otzi ot oto. Okay. They don't produce the honey, it's just simply they collect the nectar. Dvash hazizin asur she'eno elavir. I don't know what zizin are, but whatever it is, what they produce is prohibited because it's just like saliva, that is, it's a product of the animal. In other words, the reason why honey, according to the Tosefta, the reason why honey is permissible is that it's simply nectar that the bees collect. Okay? Okay. Now, from the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica, whether the nectar undergoes any alteration within the crop of the bee is a point in which authors have differed. In other words, in 1911 at least, they did not know whether or not any processing takes place of the nectar that the bees collect. But in the course of... by the bee. So this was in the science library, not in Widener, so I was able to get it. Let's get the facts here. Okay. So first of all, let's understand that not all honey comes from nectar. Bees collect nectar from flowers, but they also collect honeydew. Right? Honeydew are the secretion of various scale-like insects which feed on trees and thereabouts. Huh? What? And this article discusses in some detail the production of honeydew and the production of nectar in the trees, but if we turn to page 101, I believe. Yes. Yeah, I didn't do this, unfortunately. I was not feeling so good, and I asked one of the librarians, I asked Lydia to ask them for assistance to do the Xerox. So I don't get any response. All right.
So does 101
appear?
Yes. After 100?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Looks like an upside down B.
Right. In the head and the thorax of the worker honeybee, a number of glands are connected to the oral cavity. Next to the last page.
101.
Okay. Those important for processing and ripening the honey are the pharyngeal or hypopharyngeal glands, postcerebral, thoracic, and labial glands, and possibly also the mandibular glands. The hypopharyngeal glands lie in pairs in the front part of the head cavity. They consist of two tubes about 16 millimeters long and are studded with about 1,000 rounded glandular lobes, which open separately into the back wall of the pharynx immediately behind the oral cavity. The function of these glands is twofold. They secrete part of the food needed for brood rearing, bee milk, and they also produce a secretion rich in enzymes, diastase, invertase, glucose oxidase, used in elaborating honey. The invertase activity of the hypopharyngeal glands is dependent upon the age and the physiological condition of the bee. So what's happening here is that these glands are producing invertase, which is an enzyme which converts complex sugars into simpler sugars, which can then be digested. If we skip to the next page, where is the next page? Yes. Okay. Page 102. The raw sugar-containing materials, nectar, honeydew, or other liquids, are carried into the hive by the foraging bee in her honey sac. That means it's still in the crop inside the bee. The raw material is already mixed with saliva and received its first dilution when it was ingested by the forager. So the contents of the honey sac generally has a lower sugar concentration than the original raw material. The saliva which is added comes from the hypopharyngeal and salivary glands. By her ability to dilute the material collected, the bee is enabled to ingest highly concentrated raw materials and ripe honey. When she enters the hive, the forager passes on the contents of her honey sac to one or several house bees. She opens her mandibles with her proboscis retracted, and a drop of liquid appears at the base of the glossa. The house bee extends her proboscis fully and sucks up the drop. Experiments with sugars marked with dyes and radioactive traces have shown that the food received is quickly passed on from one bee to another. According to some authors, drones are also included in this food chain. In other words, what's happening here is the original bee partially digests this material, then vomits it up and is taken in by another bee, who then adds some more digestive juices, and then vomits it up to another bee, and so on and so forth, until eventually it's deposited in the little cell inside the hive. So honey consists...
How long does that take?
During a moderate or weak closure of the dreaded numberies, etc., and it takes, I guess, several days, does it say, if I remember correctly? After it's poured into the sack, then it's evaporated a bit, and that's the kind of honey that we have. No? Right, so the facts are a little bit more complicated than was assumed in the Tosefta. The two sources of complication. One is that the honey itself is not just simply collected and deposited, but it's collected, digested, and redigested, and redigested, and deposited. So that's item number one, which is a little bit different from what the Tosefta presumes. And the second item is that some portions of this honey are not collected from flowers, but are collected from the urine of other insects, the honeydew. By the way, I mean the famous hypothesis is that the mun is a form of honeydew made by various scale insects in the trees that were present in the desert. So, right. Okay. So now that we've got a bit of the facts straight. No, in fact, we can. The darker the honey, the higher the concentrate of the honeydew. Mm-hmm. So, okay. As I said, do not come away from this table thinking that you're not allowed to eat honey. I'm just trying to straighten out what the actual the facts are. Right. Now, I found on the web a really excellent article on the biology of honeydew, so I'll pass it out even though we don't really need it for anything we're doing tonight. But it's not a technical article like this one, but it's really... So let's go back. We saw the Tosefta. The Tosefta said, "Mepnei ma omru dvash varim mutar she'en otziin ototo ela machnisoto so dvash chazizin asur she'enu ela rir." So I don't know what zizin are, but if we assume that zizin are these types of animals that produce the honeydew, then we have a bit of a problem because these frequently feed on the honeydew. The Gemara has a slightly different take on this. So this is the Gemara in Bechorot. Sheyotzei min ha-tamei, tamei v'hiyotzei min ha-tahor, tahor. Boy minei Rav Sheshes. They asked Rav Sheshes. Mei raglayim shmor ma. Are you allowed to drink urine of a donkey? V'tibay le susim u'gmalim. Why did they single out a donkey's urine as opposed to a horse's urine or a camel's urine? The susim u'gmalim lo miboyi. The lo achiri, because those are clear, they don't have they're not cloudy. Velo dami lechalav, so they don't seem to be like milk. Maya ayil, maya nochel. The water is absorbed into the system and water is emitted. Kikav avoyli the chamor, the achiri, the urine of a donkey is cloudy. Velo dami lechalav. May miguchei kaminzi the asiri or vilma maya oil maya nochel. Behind the achiri havla the bistov. It's only some. The steam of the flesh. Some say the susim gmalim lokim boile. They didn't ask the question as to why you should or should not be permissible to drink the urine of horses or camels. The loshati in people don't drink the urine of horses. Or camels. Kikim aboyle de hamol. We ask about whether you're allowed to drink the urine of a donkey. The shatu inshi, because people drink it. Umaluli al kuna. It's a good cure for jaundice. By. What's the law? Taneitu amara sheshet nituha hayotzei mi atame tame veyotzei mi atahot taho v'hani nami mitame taho. Meitbe mipnei amrumash. Dvash dvarim mutar, mepnei shemachnisot oto lugufo, ve'en mamnatzot oto mitipon. Vuhu de'amak Rabbi Yaakov. And that's according to Rabbi Yaakov's opinion. De'amarach dubsha rachmona shariyeh. Honey was permitted by God. D'tanya Rabbi Yaakov omer, ach zet tochu mikol sheret tzahol. These are what you can eat from all flying creatures. Ze'at ochel, you eat this. Ve'iat ochel sheretz ochtamei. Sheretz ochtamei ve'ediktiv. Ela sheretz ochtamei iat ochel. Aval ata ochel, masha ochtamei mashvitz. Ve'eze zezed vashtorei. Therefore, you can eat honey from a bee. Yachol ap vash ha'gizim v'hatzirim. What about